The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com. Navigating an eating disorder during Ramadan when diet culture is everywhere. This article was written by Adeline Hossein on February 26th, and there is a note. In this op-ed, Adeline Hossein discusses how opening up about managing her eating disorder during Ramadan created a solidarity within her community she didn't know she had. Trigger warning. This piece talks about eating disorders. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, please consider calling the National Eating Disorder Association hotline at 1-800-931-2273 for support, resources, and treatment options. 8 years ago, I wrote about how Ramadan could act as both a spiritual practice and a dangerous trigger for someone living with an eating disorder. It was an attempt to give language to an experience many of us felt we couldn't say out loud. Back then, I worried every year that Ramadan would pull me back toward old habits, that the collective fasting around me would become a mirror for my internal struggles, a reminder of how easily I used self-denial to feel in control. Publishing my story filled me with a persistent fear. I didn't know how my community would receive it, whether they would see it as an act of honesty or a betrayal of something sacred. I braced myself for silence at best, backlash at worst. Instead, my inbox filled with messages from women I had never met, each one carrying a version of the same quiet confession. What I feared would isolate me had instead created a small, trembling bridge between us. The response wasn't just positive, it was generous. It reminded me that vulnerability has the power to soften shame into solidarity. So much has changed since then, both within our cultural conversations and online. What I Eat in a Day videos have existed since the 2010s, but now they feel inescapable, woven into nearly every corner of the internet. They can range from wholesome meal ideas to deeply problematic content that subtly, or not so subtly, celebrates restrictive eating. A number of experts have expressed concern about these videos, saying that they can promote unhealthy standards and feed into eating disorder thought patterns. Ramadan-specific iterations of these videos can be especially tricky. On the surface, they might seem like harmless documentation of meals, perhaps suhoor, the pre-dawn meal, and iftar, the breaking of the fast at sunset. But for someone sensitive to structured eating narratives, they echo so much of the diet culture noise we already hear outside of Ramadan. Eating right. Eating clean. Eating like an influencer. There's a line between sharing food joyfully as part of a community and turning it into a quantification of calories, portions, or worth. And that line is blurry online and emotionally dangerous offline. While platforms like TikTok have taken steps to curb harmful content, diet culture has proven itself to be adaptable. Trends like disguised body checking reveal how easily content can slip through monitoring. Users creatively repurpose seemingly innocuous formats like OOTDs in ways that still center thinness and reinforce disordered behaviors. Of course, amid all this, there has been progress. Conversations about mental health and eating disorders are more visible in Muslim spaces than ever before. In 2018, both in my own home and within the communities I was a part of, mental health was heavily stigmatized and rarely spoken about. Now, young Muslims are openly talking about why they choose not to fast, how they manage disordered thoughts during Ramadan, and why their choice doesn't demonstrate a lack of faith. Mental health advocacy from Muslim creators and clinicians has grown. Community dialogue about what it means to not fast for health, rather than encouraging shame or fear of judgment, is becoming normalized. But that visibility is double-edged. Some platforms that amplify support also amplify harmful messages about bodies and self-worth. Behind glossy reels and carefully framed iftar spreads, there may be an undercurrent of anxiety. Is this eating healthy enough? How will this affect my body? These questions don't belong in a sacred month meant for spiritual reflection. Yet, social media blurs the spiritual with the aesthetic. You can scroll right past someone sharing a prayer and land on someone sharing a calorie count. So, here's where I am now. Ramadan still stirs something in me, a mix of spiritual longing, gratitude, and wariness. I know that fasting isn't inherently dangerous, but I also know that enforcing it on someone whose relationship with food is complicated can be traumatic. I've learned to advocate for myself more fiercely by setting boundaries, stepping away from certain content online during Ramadan, and reclaiming how I'm observing. Ultimately, Ramadan is a mirror held up not to food, but to intention, to how we define strength, discipline, faith, and self-care. And on social media, we now at least have a choice. To follow feeds that celebrate movement and nourishment instead of restriction and thinness. To amplify voices that talk about healing, not just dieting. If anything, I hope this era of digital change, with all its contradictions, can teach us that food, faith, and identity don't need to be battlegrounds. They can be spaces for compassion, conversation, and community. And that choosing health, whether it looks like fasting, modifying your practice, or stepping away, is always an act of courage. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson has died at 84. This article was written by Liam Ness on February 17th. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, a leading figure in the civil rights movement who ran twice as the Democratic candidate for president, has died at the age of 84. The news was confirmed in a statement from his family, who noted that Jackson died peacefully. "Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world," the Jackson family wrote. "We shared him with the world, and in return, the world became part of our extended family. His unwavering belief in justice, equality, and love uplifted millions, and we ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by. While the family did not specify a cause of death, the news came after Jackson's hospitalization in November last year for progressive supranuclear palsy, PSP, a rare neurodegenerative condition. He was also diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2017 and hospitalized twice with COVID in recent years. Born on October 8, 1941, in Greenville, South Carolina, Jackson showed an interest in politics from an early age. He excelled in school, becoming class president and earning a football scholarship to the University of Illinois, though he later transferred to North Carolina A&T, an HBCU, where he first became involved with the civil rights movement. In 1960, he was arrested along with seven other students for a silent demonstration in a library reserved for white students, eventually leading to its desegregation. After moving to Chicago and being ordained as a minister, he caught the attention of Martin Luther King Jr., later participating in the Selma to Montgomery marches, and being elected by King as the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Operation Breadbasket, dedicated to providing economic opportunities and jobs for black communities, partly through the use of strategic boycotts. In 1968, Jackson was with King when he was assassinated in Memphis, controversially appearing on television the following day, wearing clothes still stained with King's blood. In the wake of King's death, Jackson unofficially assumed the role of the leader of the civil rights movement, becoming a highly influential political figure through Operation Push, which he established in the early 1970s after a schism within Operation Breadbasket. In the 1980s, he achieved further notability for his two campaigns as the Democratic nominee for president, running on a platform he dubbed the Rainbow Coalition, uniting disenfranchised and marginalized voters across a variety of backgrounds, and rebuking the negative impact of President Reagan's policies on both black and low-income voters. While his 1984 run was unsuccessful, it boosted his national profile significantly. And when he ran again in 1988 on a platform of increased public spending and universal health care, he took an early lead, eventually earning nearly 7 million voters, though he'd lose to Michael Dukakis. While Jackson was not the first black candidate to run as the Democratic nominee for president, many figures, including President Obama himself, have noted his importance in paving the way for black political leaders on the national stage over the following decades. Jackson also faced several controversies throughout his career. His use of a pejorative term for Jewish people in the 1980s led to a strained relationship with Jewish leaders and accusations of anti-Semitism. In his early career, Jackson was also criticized for his anti-abortion views and opposition to same-sex marriage, though he later changed his position on both issues. The revelation of an extramarital affair in 2001 also drew criticism, as did a series of scandals including Jackson's son, Jesse Jackson Jr., in the early 2010s, with Jackson Jr. being convicted and sentenced to prison for misuse of campaign funds while running as the U.S. representative for Illinois' 2nd Congressional District. More than anything, however, Jackson will be remembered for his powerful oratory, his influential approach to building coalitions across racial and economic divides, and the precedent he set for later black leaders. Those who have shared tributes to Jackson already include civil rights campaigner Al Sharpton, who honored Jackson as his mentor, Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter Bernice, and the recently elected New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani. He marched, he ran, he organized, and he preached justice without apology, Mamdani wrote. May we honor him not just in words, but in struggle. And there is a note. This story originally appeared in Vogue. Our next article from the teenmagazine.com. ED versus EA versus RD. When should you apply? This article was written by Amy Guerin on January 19th. The college application process has no shortage of stress, from actually assembling a college list right down to writing supplemental essays. Amidst this, there's also the decision of when to apply and how this choice could impact your admittance. The first step to approaching this problem is reviewing the difference between early decision, ED, early action, EA, and regular decision, RD, to pick which one works best for your situation. EA versus ED. What's the difference? Early action, EA, is a non-binding way of applying early, meaning you can apply EA to multiple schools. Deadlines are typically at the start of November, with results coming out between mid-December to the end of January. Since it's both early and non-binding, students have more time to weigh their options before graduation. They can consider factors such as a school's location or the financial aid plan offered. From there, they can pick what works best for them. Early decision, ED, is a binding form of application, though not legally binding, and has a slightly higher acceptance rate compared to early action or regular decision, although this difference is typically marginal. Since early decision is binding, you're expected to withdraw applications from all other schools if you're accepted. Technically, you can decline an early decision acceptance, but only for serious reasons, such as a family emergency or insufficient funds. Other, more trivial reasons, like changing your mind, can potentially hurt your chances of getting into other schools due to your name being flagged among other admissions offices. Generally, if you have a valid reason for declining an early decision offer, you'll need to involve your school's counselor and thoroughly explain your situation. Given the nature of early decision, it's best to reserve it for a dream school, one you're positive you would attend if admitted. In my case, EA was the most attractive option for my applications. I started working in August, finalizing my list of schools, retaking the SAT, writing my personal statement, etc., and began applying in October. By December, I was done and receiving results from the schools I applied to with early action. That being said, many of the schools I applied to only had ED or RD, so a majority of my applications were through regular decision. Regular decision. Regular decision, RD, typically runs until early January, with results typically out in late March to the start of April. Since its deadline is past EA and ED, This gives students more time to strengthen their application. For example, if one wants to retake the SAT and improve their score, they'd have 4 opportunities to retake it between August and December, which could then be used on their application. This extra time makes regular decision a popular approach, although some students may not enjoy having to wait until spring for results to be released. Final thoughts. When it comes to college applications, there's no one size fits all. Individual circumstances come into play when deciding when to apply. In general, early decision, ED, should be reserved for a dream school. Early action, EA, lets you apply early with no strings attached. And regular decision, RD, gives you more time to work on your application. The college application process is understandably nerve-wracking. But when it comes to deciding when to apply, it doesn't have to be. Review your options and weigh the pros and cons of each when deciding when to apply, and the process will be a lot simpler. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Taylor Swift's song, Dorothea, is confirmed to be about Selena Gomez. This article was written by Kara Nesvig on March 3rd. There's a lot of lore around the decades-long best friendship of Selena Gomez and Taylor Swift. The two, who have been pals since they dated Nick and Joe Jonas, respectively, have been by each other's side through it all. And now Gomez has confirmed that a long-running fan theory about their friendship is indeed true. In a new episode of the podcast Friends Keep Secrets, hosted by Gomez's husband Benny Blanco, she revealed that Swift's song Dorothea from Evermore is about her. That joyful shriek you just heard, it's millions of Swifties yelling, "We knew it!" in the background. What is the Taylor Swift song, Dorothea, about? Like many of the songs on Folklore and Evermore, Dorothea is allegedly a story song about a fictional character Swift created, Dorothea, with additional elements drawn from real life. In the song, the narrator sings to a long-lost friend who left their small town to become a star. "A tiny screen's the only place I see you now." Fans have long thought Dorothea was inspired by Gomez, including the name of the song itself, as Gomez loves The Wizard of Oz. The song also nods to Gomez's beauty line, Rare Beauty, with the lyric, "You're a queen selling dreams, selling makeup and magazines." The pageants Gomez did as a child, and her superstar status. And if you're ever tired of being known for who you know. What did Selena Gomez say about Dorothea? Gomez didn't give a complete lyrical breakdown on the Friends Keep Secrets podcast, though she did confirm that the song was inspired by her friendship with Swift, and how Swift has watched Gomez evolve through the years. "Well, Dorothea is about me, one of her songs," Gomez explained. "And I feel like a lot of moments, huge moments that were self-defining, from relationships to family to love to hate, all of it in between, we were figuring it out because I was 15 and she was 18 and we didn't really know what was going on. And so we've never seen each other any differently. When I listen to it, I'm so impressed how it's eloquently put." Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Did Zendaya and Tom Holland get married? Law Roach says, wedding already happened. This article was written by Karen Nesvig on March 1st. Are Zendaya and Tom Holland already married? The answer is, potentially, yes. The couple, who met as co-stars on Spider-Man and got engaged during the holidays in 2024, have always been really private and low-key about their relationship. Now, according to Zendaya's longtime stylist, Law Roach, they've tied the knot. Access Hollywood asked Roach during the 2026 Actor Awards about potential wedding plans for Z and Holland, and he shared that the two are already living in wedded bliss. "The wedding's already happened," Roach said in an interview from the Actor Awards red carpet. "You missed it." When the reporter asked him to confirm that this was true, he did, saying, "It's very true." Roach had previously said he'd, of course, be helping Zendaya with her dress. "It does appear to be true, especially if recent paparazzi shots of Zendaya are any indication." The Euphoria star was seen in mid-February wearing what certainly looks to be a gold wedding band on her hand, though the couple haven't shared any details about a wedding yet. But given how quiet they kept their engagement, with Zendaya subtly debuting her engagement ring at the 2025 Golden Globes, we wouldn't be surprised if we don't hear much about their nuptials, if anything. Maybe Law Roach will share some more details on his next red carpet. Of course, we've got so many questions. Where did they get married? How many guests were there? What did Zendaya wear? It's up to the couple to share what they see fit on their own timeline. But either way, we're sending so many congratulations and all the happiness to Tom and Zendaya. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.